This is the Outsource Accelerator Podcast, exploring business and outsourcing mastery. Let's do it. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Outsource Accelerator Podcast. This is episode 128, and my name is Derek Gallimore. So today we are joined by Chris Urbano of Winery Philippines. I have got Chris on this podcast because he's a really interesting guy. He has pretty much grown up in Southeast Asia. He has family origins in Australia. He's done a little bit of management consulting time in Australia and now returned back to the Philippines, where he's been here for the last 4 years. He's a wealth of knowledge in terms of kind of business, commerce, management fundamentals, but also has really interesting insights into the Philippines, as I'm sure you'll hear. So today we look into his journey to this point, and I'm sure you'll find this really interesting. Of course, if you want any details or you want to get in touch with Chris, then all of that is in our show notes at outsourceaccelerator.com/128. Enjoy. Hi, and welcome back, everybody. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Chris Urbano of Winery Philippines. Chris has a really interesting background, which I want to kind of deep dive with him here. And of course, he is far better at explaining that than I. But effectively, he has, you know, spent the vast majority of his life in Southeast Asia, and he's now here in the Philippines building businesses here. So, hi, Chris. Thanks for chatting.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Derek.
And I suppose initially, do you want to just give us a brief introduction to you, and then we can deep dive a little bit more into that?
Sure. So I'm an entrepreneur and still, I guess, part-time consultant based here in the Philippines. I moved back here about 4 years ago from Australia, but I spent time here in my youth as a university student where I studied Philippine politics and Philippine language, or Tagalog. In the last 4 years, I've been focused on a couple of different ventures, largely in the sort of the nexus of, I guess, F&B, e-commerce, and digital marketing. So the first of those, as you mentioned, is Winery Philippines, which is the Philippines' first curated online wine marketplace, and you know, brings great wine from around the world into puts it in the hands of Philippine consumers. The second thing is that I started a YouTube channel because I love cooking and I love Filipino food. So I've become, I guess, an advocate of the global Filipino food movement that's taking place through my online cooking show, Maputing Cooking, which is, you can check that out at YouTube. If you search for Chris Urbano or Maputing Cooking, you'll find it. And there I showcase Filipino cuisine, teach Filipinos how to actually cook their own cuisine, which has been sort of a fascinating vehicle, not only to Philippine culture, but also a way for me to really explore and understand digital marketing trends in the Philippines. So I found it to be very useful. Also opens a lot of doors, you know, if you sort of get on the TV a bit and have a bit of public profile in the Philippines, for sure. So that's a couple of the things that I do at the moment here, and obviously sort of a bit of consulting on the side, often for startups, but for big global companies as well, you know, to help pay the bills while we're building the company.
Yeah, fantastic. And you know, I've seen you on YouTube and I've seen you on TV, and you really are making quite an impact here in the Philippines. And slightly, you know, I have spoke to other expats here, and one of the guys, Judah Hirsch, who is of Salpay, Solarium, he suggested, actually, which really struck a chord with me, some countries, it's very difficult to be an expat. And some countries, like the Philippines, it's actually very easy to be an expat, in that doors are open for you, people are very open, people are very friendly. And of course, there's kind of complexities in that, because the you know, society is very complicated and you know, multifaceted. But you really have made quite a splash here. But it's also, I think, quite unusual for many expats to really settle here and call it their home, because the Philippines is quite off the radar to many people. People know about Bali, people know about Thailand, but kind of Philippines isn't really there. What was it about your journey that brought you to the Philippines in the first place, and then what struck a chord with you that meant that you're still here?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's a little bit of a long story. I'll try and synthesize it down to the key points. I mean, I was a I actually grew up in Indonesia and spent a lot of my, high school days there in Jakarta when I was a high school student. I went back there for university as well. And I've now said that I studied at university in Indonesia and the Philippines. Well, actually, where I really studied was the Australian National University, where I hold an Asian Studies degree, Southeast Asia Specialist, Indonesia and Philippines. So that allowed me to kind of come up here for university. But I guess I always imagined myself having a career in Southeast Asia and probably Indonesia. But that all changed when I met my now wife on a school bus in Canberra when I was studying there. And I actually at first thought she was an Indonesian when I first saw her. I remember this very clearly. And I thought, oh, great, you know, because she's both very pretty and, you know, somebody I can practice language with and all of this and probably from the same place. And then I sort of sat down, introduced myself on the bus one day, and she told me she's from the Philippines. And little did I know that, you know, 5 years after that, I would find myself, you know, moving to the Philippines and thinking to myself, well, I like her and I've been in Indonesia for so many years. I'll broaden my expertise into the Philippines. You know, academically and study and learn that language, because I didn't want to be one of those, I guess there's a lot of expats who come to Asia and never really deeply engage with the, you know, culture and language of their wife. I don't want to be one of those guys who, you know, at Christmas parties is just sort of drinking a beer in the corner because he can't have a chat to the family. But
which is even more common in the Philippines, isn't it? Because they are just so good at English that I think very many expats don't even attempt to take on the language.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the funny thing is that almost means that you end up in the corner more, because although you can have the functional communication of would you like more food and, you know, did you sleep well last night and so forth, you I think language is so critical to getting, you know, beneath the surface of a culture and connecting with people at a different language. I'd say language and food, actually. They're the sort of universal connectors. So I suppose I found that in some ways you know, it's even more important to make the effort in a place like the Philippines, because the functional communication comes easy. So I think you don't tend to get beyond the surface if you don't make that extra effort, even to learn, you know, 100 or 200 words and a few phrases. It makes an enormous difference. So I've never regretted the time I spent studying Tagalog.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I actually just took up Tagalog pretty much at the beginning of the year, and I made a commitment to that because of Outsource Accelerator, and you know, I am trying to be a bit of a spokesman for the Philippines and outsourcing, and I thought it was somewhat kind of remiss if I didn't then take on the language. And I've been here 4 years myself, and it's a combination of just being kind of not lazy and also respectful of the environment you're in, really, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And I think, you know, it's funnily enough, I mean, I'm a Bahasa speaker as well, and I spent more time studying Indonesian. But I use Tagalog all the time when I travel. I mean, the fascinating thing about this language is that if you go to and I mean, this year I've already been to sort of Italy, the east and west coast of the U.S., Singapore and Hong Kong, and I have used Tagalog in every single one of those countries, whereas I've not used Indonesian once. You know, you don't use Indonesian outside of Indonesia, maybe a bit of Malaysia, Singapore, Brunei, but Tagalog is a language where, because of the global Filipino diaspora, I find myself constantly hearing it spoken, you know, on the subway in Milan or, you know, at the airport. Sure. It's all Filipino, so it's actually a very, very handy language wherever you are in the world.
Yeah, they're very, very well traveled, aren't they? They're certainly very industrious. And then, so what is your take on the Philippines versus Southeast Asia? I mean, you are very commercially astute, you're in business yourself, and you know, how do you compare the pros and cons? Obviously our audience is here because of interest or potential interest in outsourcing, and the Philippines is known as one of the primary outsourcing destinations in the world, and we're actually trying to pitch it as the kind of Swiss banking of outsourcing as a destination. But, you know, how do you see the commercial aspects of the Philippines versus other Southeast Asian communities and cultures?
Yeah, well, perhaps let me start on sort of the question. It might touch on your point earlier about, you know, what was the decision to actually rebase here. And I think the Philippines presents, or you might say Southeast Asia presents, a number of arbitrage opportunities. For, you know, any entrepreneur, you know, if you're mobile, you're based in Southeast Asia, the arbitrages are typically around taxation. So you're normally facing a lower rate than, you know, the developed economies. Certainly between the Philippines and Australia, just looking at headline tax rates, there's a significant difference. The second arbitrage is the cost of living. So if you are looking at starting a business or a venture, you can afford to, you know, your savings go a lot further, or your runway is a lot longer being based in a market like this, because it's low cost to live and consume in this economy, again, relative to developed economies. And the third one is, to your point, the arbitrage of labor, which means you can hire people for a few hundred dollars a month instead of a few thousand dollars a month. And when you combine those three arbitrages for people who are somewhat internationally mobile in their skill sets or their career or even their outlook and aspirations, that presents an opportunity to, I guess, unlock certain career trajectories, or the opportunity to go from being a rat race worker in Sydney to being a, you know, business owner, somebody who, you know, raises money and builds companies. That's something that for a lot of people, you know, you need a lot more net worth behind you to do that in Australia than you do if you were to rebase to somewhere like here. So I think that's sort of the initial starting point. And then you look at within Southeast Asia, how the Philippines stacks up. And on that perspective, I would say on the labor arbitrage, it's probably the most favorable market to work in, predominantly because of the English-speaking workforce. And that, for me, is a big draw card to be in the Philippines over, you know, places like Indonesia, where obviously would be an obvious choice for me given my background there. But I would say on the other two arbitrages around, say, tax and cost of living, the Philippines probably is I think it's fair to say, a bit less competitive. And certainly Singapore in terms of the tax rate one faces here. So I think the goal, if you're in the Philippines, is how do you tap the labor arbitrage, the relatively low cost of living, but then kind of structure your affairs in a way that you're largely servicing an overseas customer, or your company headquarters may be somewhere else, and the Philippines might just be a source of your labor, but your revenues might be booked largely in another market.
Yeah, I think the world is becoming more of a smorgasbord, isn't it? And I think it sounds, you know, you were brought up in an expat community and you have a sense of using the world to your advantage, which I think more people should kind of click onto. But kind of any market has its pros and cons, isn't it? If you are based in Monaco, there's a lot of wealth, but it's a small market, and, you know, there's tax considerations and things like that. And certainly Australia, you know, it's a very kind of commercially viable country, but taxes are high and cost of living is extremely high. And as you suggest, it really, I think more people will start to click on to the fact that you can base yourself in one market or build things out in one market and sell to another market. It's really becoming, you know, a lot more interactive in terms of treating the world as one global marketplace, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I mean, you know, certainly technology has broken down a lot of the traditional barriers to cross-border movements of, I guess, ideas, but also labor. But I think digital has actually meant that labor can flow across borders without people flowing across borders. I think that's really the big change of the last, say, 10 or 15 years, and part of the promise of the internet era is that people don't necessarily need to move to be performing work and services. So in the past, the outsourcing movement was, you know, a large, typically manufacturing MNC would, you know, drop a factory in, you know, a place with cheaper labor. Now you actually don't need to move the factory or the infrastructure. You can just basically, you know, get online and identify somebody who can help you out from a low-cost market. And you know, even frankly, in the Philippines, I find that I'm exercising some arbitrage between, you know, Makati City's central CBD, Manila labor prices are quite high. And the first website I built was actually done by this developer that I think I found through Craigslist, which is a murky place to source talent, for sure. Yeah. But I think my first website was built by a 19-year-old girl based in a village in Laguna for about $200. And you know, and we did it in four weeks or something like this in her spare time. And that's just a crazy cheap way of getting things done. So if you're prepared to adopt new ways of working and look for that opportunity, it's definitely there.
Yeah, there's always kind of cheaper and cheaper markets, isn't there? So it's finding that balance of good skill and depth of talent versus then the price of things. But yeah, and you know, to your point on the flow of production, I realize that as well, that you know, historically things were able to be controlled at borders. Like there was manufacturing, which of course you can control the inflow of manufactured goods, and I suppose the original type of exportation was migrant labor, and of course you can very easily control that at the borders. But now, as you say, with services as a product, it really can't be monitored or controlled at all, can it? And I look at Donald Trump, who is trying to maybe or potentially clamp down on outsourcing, and it's really difficult to, you know, an email, just sending an email could contain anything between kind of $10 or $10 million worth of value in what is contained within the content. And you would actually, it's unpoliceable, isn't it, in that you would have to read emails and make sure that there's no transfer of knowledge or service or information. And I think like border controls and customs and taxation really have to kind of catch up with the new economy of just information transfer, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's certainly the case. I mean, and I think it's not confined just to this issue. Obviously, pretty much any disruptive digital technology, you know, ride sharing and economy, you know, the Airbnbs and Ubers and so on, that's creating massive regulatory challenges everywhere. I think this one of sort of cross-border movements, there's a couple of things in there. There's one obviously around taxation, which I obviously I'd be shocked if a lot of the work in the Philippines is generating tax revenue for either the country it's being sourced from or for the Philippines either. I think there's also issues around minimum wage standards. You know, so at the moment, you've got websites like I think the one that comes to mind is Fiverr, just because it's a unit of value, like $5, and you can, you know, get various services done, or you put up an ad for what you want done for $5. And you know, the idea there is that $5, is that above or below the minimum wage in a lot of countries? And may or may not be. I don't have a view, but the point is, I don't think anybody really knows. There's, I think, a whole labour market issue as well. Of you know, are people working in these industries employees? Are they contractors? What are the protections that govern these digital workers of the 21st century? And I think those are all questions that are starting to get asked, and the solutions are probably, you know, some years still away.
Yeah, and I think any of the historic values are completely different now, aren't they? You know, are people employees or contractors, and can it really be held to those older concepts? But I think also the difficulty is that regulation and institutions, they move too slowly, and I think society is now evolving at such a pace that it's always going to be a few steps behind in terms of actually the relevance of what they're actually attending to, you know?
But, yeah, and I mean, I'll be honest with you, and I'll preface this by saying, you know, Winery Philippines is a completely compliant employer here in the Philippines. But when I was starting out and sort of bootstrapping and operating out of my my apartment, which is, you know, actually how I started the company, the first few people I dealt with was just on a sort of brokered by the internet, typically cash only basis. And funnily enough, those workers are all happy with that. And when I said to them, you know, we've incorporated the company and I now need to put you on a proper labor agreement that's compliant with Philippine law, and now I'm going to, you know, clip, you know, X percent of your salary going to pay for all these various government programs, none of them were particularly happy about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you can understand why, because these people don't really receive anything from the government, or, you know, that can certainly be the argument. It is a problem, isn't it? And also, you know, I want to get you back for our next episode to actually deep dive into winery, and we can talk about that there. But it's in these developing countries, it's actually far more difficult to set up a corporate structure, to get your taxes done, to comply with all the labor laws. And actually, it becomes an impediment to doing things properly, doesn't it? And it becomes an impediment to actually setting up commercially viable enterprises because of the structures. It's a bit of a catch-22, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think that's, I mean, back to your point of the sort of challenges in the Philippines and versus other markets. I mean, there is a red tape and compliance cost here, and you can measure it in both dollars or pesos, and you can also measure it in terms of time and time taken to set up and establish something. And, you know, I would view that the, you know, if you like, the regulatory red tape and, you know, dare I say, corruption burden of building a business in the Philippines is probably represents somewhere between, you know, certainly in the early stages of your company, you know, 20-30% of your expenditures or your revenue, however you're thinking about that. And when you think about the time taken to stand up a business, I think, you know, in developed countries, you can sort of put something up in a couple of days. In the Philippines, you know, you're looking at sort of six months is sort of a reasonable time frame just to get a basic, you know, company establishment and maybe rent an office. And that's just a staggering amount of upfront time.
And it's sad, isn't it? And it's keeping the population and the kind of the entrepreneurial zest of the country down, really, isn't it? Which is exactly what they don't need.
Yeah, and it's frustrating to see, and it's frustrating to experience it. And I think what it means is that unlocking the promise of the Philippines, you know, unfortunately, despite, you know, the internet enabling a lot of new business models here, at some level, that promise is still constrained by the, you know, the government structures and the inefficiencies of Philippine bureaucracy and the challenges of the operating environment. So that, like, for, you know, when engaging in this market, if you don't want to do it yourself, that the people you do work with have that sort of deep experience and long time in the market, and they're people who would have had to invest in it over the over many years. As you know, I think you yourself and myself, I think it would be fair to say that 4 years in country, we're only now becoming, I suspect, useful people who know how to get stuff done in this market, whereas that would be probably a 1 or 2 year journey had I gone and based myself in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's no, interesting. Thank you, Chris. I want to get you back so we can sort of deep dive into Winery Philippines. If people want to contact you in the meantime, how can they do that?
Yeah, so get in touch anytime at chris@winery.ph, and you can check out what we do at Winery Philippines at winery.ph, the URL. So I hope to hear from you.
Fantastic. And, of course, all of that is in the show notes. Thanks very much, Chris.
Cheers.
Okay, that was Chris Urbano of Winery Philippines, or winery.ph. If you want to get in touch with Chris, then, of course, go to our show notes, which is at outsourceaccelerator.com/128. And if you want to ask us anything at all, then please do so at ask@outsourceaccelerator.com. See you next time.